Right now, the absolute frontier of modern psychiatry doesn't look like, a clean white laboratory.
No, it definitely doesn't.
Right. It doesn't look like a perfectly targeted daily pill either. It actually looks like an ancient root bark from West Africa that can and literally does stop your heart.
Yeah, or a 1960s battlefield anesthetic that can slowly dissolve your bladder over time.
Exactly. So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are exploring a really fascinating and, frankly, extensive 2026 briefing from the OTW Journal.
It's titled Ibogaine versus Ketamine.
Yeah, that's the one. And I want to be super clear right up front for you listening. The goal today is not to crown a winner between a plant and a syringe.
Right, it's not a competition.
Not at all. The mission here is to cut through the incredible amount of hype surrounding both of these substances. We want to figure out exactly where they converge, where they diverge, and what they fundamentally demand of the human body to actually achieve their results.
Because the problems they are treating are just so massive.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are looking at two of the hardest, most entrenched problems humans face, right? Severe addiction and treatment-resistant depression.
Yeah.
And the tools we're discussing to treat them are, well, they're extreme.
Extreme is definitely the right word for it. We're looking at two pharmacological agents that reach a shared destination, which is essentially treating the untreatable through completely opposite routes.
Right, totally opposite.
And to really grasp what these tools are doing, we have to, peel back the breathless headlines. We have to look at their origins first, and then look deeply at what they are physically doing to the architecture of the human brain.
I think origin stories are the perfect place to start.
Yeah, it sets the stage.
Because before we get into the cellular mechanics, we need to understand the specific battlegrounds these drugs were built for, like their centers of gravity.
Right.
Let's look at ibogaine first. The briefing notes it's a complex alkaloid. It's extracted from the root bark of the Tabernanthia boga shrub.
A shrub native to West Africa, yeah.
And its primary clinical target is addiction, specifically opioid dependence.
It has a very specific clinical signature that observational studies have documented for decades now. Ibogaine has this remarkable, almost unbelievable ability to interrupt acute opioid withdrawal after just a single dose.
A single dose.
Yeah. Patients routinely experience a precipitous drop in physical cravings that can last for weeks or even months.
Wow.
And recently, that therapeutic window is being tested against severe trauma and traumatic brain injury, too.
Which is huge for the veteran community.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But to your point about origins, this molecule wasn't designed in a corporate laboratory. It is deeply rooted in the Bwedi spiritual tradition of Gabon and Cameroon.
Right, where high doses of the root bark are consumed in these rigorous community-led initiation rites.
Exactly. It was always meant to be an overwhelming physiological and psychological ordeal.
Then you look across the aisle at ketamine, and the contrast is just glaring.
It's used night and
I
day.
mean, ketamine is a synthetic dissociative anesthetic. It was cooked up by chemists in a lab in 1962.
Yeah, and widely used on battlefields, like in Vietnam.
Right, because it could safely sedate a wounded soldier without depressing their breathing, which is obviously critical.
But its center of gravity today has shifted entirely. Now it's heavily focused on mood disorders, so treatment-resistant depression and acute suicidality.
And its clinical signature is speed, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
While ibogaine is known for long-lasting disruption of withdrawal, ketamine is known for lifting crushing severe depression in a matter of hours.
Hours. That's incredible.
Now, we are starting to see the edges blur a bit in recent clinical trials.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, researchers are testing ketamine for substance abuse, and they're looking at ibogaine for depression.
Oh, okay. So they're kind of bleeding into each other's territory.
A little bit, yeah. But their core foundations, addiction for one, mood for the other, those remain distinct.
So if I'm understanding this right, if I'm visualizing the mechanics here based on what you're saying, ibogaine is like a sledgehammer meant to smash right through the brick wall of opioid withdrawal.
That's a good way to put it.
While ketamine is more like a set of jumper cables trying to rapidly restart a stalled engine in a depressed brain,
Right.
or to try another analogy, if your brain is a computer, ketamine feels like downloading a massive software patch to get the programs running again,
Sure.
whereas ibogaine feels like totally wiping the hard drive and reinstalling the entire operating system from scratch.
What's fascinating here is that your hard drive analogy maps perfectly to the raw pharmacology.
Really?
Yeah. The origin stories, an overwhelming spiritual ordeal versus a synthetic, battlefield tool, they completely dictate how they rewrite the brain.
Which brings us to that cellular level. I really want to look under the hood at how they actually achieve these resets.
Let's do it.
The briefing describes Ibogaine's mechanism of action not as a clean, targeted lever, but as a shotgun.
A shotgun is highly accurate in this context. When Ibogaine enters the brain, it doesn't just hit one receptor. It hits a massive spread all at once.
Just everywhere.
Pretty much. It acts as an antagonist at the NMDA receptors. It modulates the kappa and myopioid receptors.
Okay.
It binds to sigma-2 sites. It inhibits the serotonin transporter. And it blocks nicotinic acetylcholine receptors.
Wait. Well, hold on.
It's a lot.
Yeah. That sounds like you just spilled an entire bucket of keys and you're jamming all of them into the door, hoping one turns the lock.
It does sound like that, yeah.
In modern medicine, aren't we always taught that targeted is better? Like precision medicine. How is a chaotic shotgun approach actually superior for treating something like heroin addiction?
Well, it challenges our entire framework of drug design.
How so?
The prevailing hypothesis in the research is that addiction isn't just a single broken lock. Addiction is a systemic, whole brain disease.
So it's everywhere.
Right. It fundamentally rewires how the brain perceives reward, memory, and survival. Can't just flip one switch to undo years of structural rewiring.
I see.
The messiness of Ibogaine hitting all those systems at once is thought to be the exact reason it works. It forces a broad system reboot.
A hard drive wipe. And the briefing highlights a specific piece of that reboot that really caught my eye. Something called GDNF.
Yes, glial cell line-derived neurotrophic factor.
Right. I know neurotrophic factor essentially means brain fertilizer, but how does this play into the addiction reset?
In preclinical studies, when researchers micro-injected Ibogaine into the ventral tegmental area.
Which is what, exactly?
Oh, sorry. It's the major hub of the brain's reward circuitry.
Okay, got it.
When they injected it there, it induced a massive surge of this GDNF fertilizer and this sharply reduced alcohol self-administration in animal models.
Oh, wow.
But the truly incredible part, the part that researchers are so focused on right now, is that GDNF creates a self-amplifying loop.
What does that mean?
It sustains its own expression.
Meaning the drug flips a switch and then the brain keeps that switch held down long after the drug is actually gone.
Yes. And that creates a molecular pathway for durable, lasting change from just one single exposure.
That is wild.
But there's a second metabolic feature contributing to that long-lasting effect, and it actually involves the liver.
Oh, the CYP2D6 enzyme.
Exactly.
The briefing mentioned this. The liver rapidly converts Ibogaine into an active metabolite called noribogaine, right?
Right. And while the original Ibogaine is cleared out of your system in just a few hours,
this noribogaine metabolite has a massive half-life.
It does. It hangs around in the blood plasma for roughly 28 to 49 hours.
That's days.
Yeah, continuing to block serotonin reuptake and bind to opioid receptors for days. So the therapeutic effect has this massive long tail.
Okay, so hold that messy, long-lasting shotgun blast in your mind and compare it to ketamine.
Ketamine's story is much cleaner. It is a highly targeted lever.
Right, the jumper cables.
Specifically, it is a non-competitive NMDA receptor antagonist. Oh. But its antidepressant action isn't just about blocking that receptor. It's about exactly where in the brain it blocks it.
The briefing calls this the disinhibition model. But I have to admit, reading through the mechanics of GABA interneurons left me a bit lost.
It gets dense.
Yeah. Can you break down how blocking a receptor actually lifts depression?
Let's use a car analogy.
Love those.
In your brain, you have excitatory neurons. That's the gas pedal. And you have inhibitory neurons called GABA interneurons, which act as the brakes.
Okay. Gas and brakes.
Ketamine goes in and preferentially blocks the NMDA receptors on those specific brake pedals. It silences them.
So it essentially cuts the brake lines on the brain's excitatory system.
Exactly. By removing the brake, you get a brief, intense surge of a neurotransmitter called glutamate in the prefrontal cortex.
You are flooding the engine with gas.
Right. That surge of glutamate then activates a totally different set of receptors, the AMPA receptors.
And that AMPA activation is the actual trigger for healing, isn't it?
Yes, it sets off a cascade. It releases BDNF, which is another type of brain fertilizer, and activates the MTOR pathway.
And this literally drives the rapid growth of new dendritic spines and synapses. Like, the brain is physically sprouting new connections to route around the depressed neural pathways.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you block that AMPA step in animal models, the antidepressant effect completely disappears.
Wow, so that proves it.
It gives us strong evidence that the neuroplasticity, the literal rewiring and sprouting of new connections, is doing the heavy lifting, not the temporary dissociative high of the drug.
Though the briefing does point out that there are still massive debates happening in the scientific community about this exact mechanism.
Science at the frontier is rarely settled. Take the enantiomer debate, for instance.
Oh, right. Left and right-handed molecules.
Yeah. Ketamine molecules have left and right-handed versions. The FDA approved the S form, esketamine, which is sold as Spravato because it's a more potent NMDA blocker.
It fit the model perfectly.
But the R form, arketamine, shows antidepressant effects despite having much weaker NMDA binding.
And the briefing notes, a highly anticipated phase 2A trial for arketamine actually missed its primary endpoint in 2023. Why did that matter so much?
It mattered because it challenged the core foundation of the disinhibition model we just talked about.
The cut breaks model.
Right. If the weaker NMDA blocker isn't working in trials, it forces researchers to ask if we actually understand the mechanism as well as we think we do.
Interesting.
There's also a heavy debate over ketamine's metabolites. A phase 1 trial from 2024 looked at a metabolite called HNK.
Right. And researchers suspect HNK might produce those exact antidepressant effects, the structural rewiring without causing the intense dissociative high.
Exactly.
Just imagine getting the neuroplasticity without the hallucinogenic trip.
That would be the holy grail.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Because these cellular mechanisms are fundamentally opposite, ibogaine's long-lived metabolite and self-amplifying GDNF loop versus ketamine's brief targeted glutamate surge, the actual physical experience for the patient sitting in the room is completely different.
Oh, totally. The rhythm of the dose totally changes the burden on the patient and, by extension, the burden on the healthcare system.
Let's talk about the timeline for ibogaine because it's an absolute marathon.
It is.
We're talking about a single massive session. The clinical sources describe it as inducing a oneurogenic state. What does that actually look like for the person in the bed?
A oneurogenic state is essentially a waking dream.
A waking dream.
Yeah. The patient is largely immobilized, often experiencing vivid, rapidly firing memories. They are confronting past traumas, reviewing their life choices for hours on end.
Sounds intense.
It is. This intense psychological phase sits inside a broader physiological experience that spans roughly 24 to 36 hours.
It's a deeply grueling ordeal.
Very much so.
But the results map to that intensity. In one prospective study cited in the journal, 78% of opioid-dependent users showed absolutely zero objective signs of withdrawal within 48 hours of that single dose.
That said, always gets me.
And 79% reported minimal cravings.
To go from entrenched physical opioid dependence to zero objective withdrawal signs in 48 hours is staggering.
It's a medical miracle.
Well, because of that long tail of the norbogaine metabolite we discussed, it acts as a one-and-done intervention to break the immediate cycle of dependence.
Ketamine, conversely, is incredibly fast, but transient.
Right. A standard 40-minute 4B infusion of ketamine can pull someone out of acute suicidality in roughly 2 hours.
Which is also incredible in a crisis.
Definitely. But the source points out that single dose typically loses its effect within just 1 to 2 weeks.
Because it's a brief glutamate surge, the plasticity it creates is fragile. It needs to be reinforced.
Exactly. So the logistics of ketamine demand repeated infusions, a heavy induction series up front, followed by open-ended maintenance treatments.
So for you listening, think about the commitment here.
It's a lifestyle change.
It really is. It is basically the difference between undergoing one massive, grueling 24-hour surgery that attempts to rip the root problem out all at once versus signing up for a lifetime of weekly physical therapy to keep the symptoms at bay.
You are trading the overwhelming intensity of a single day for the persistence and cost of an ongoing regimen.
And naturally, with those extreme but distinct patient experiences come extreme and totally distinct biological risks.
Yes, let's not sugarcoat it.
The hazards of these two drugs are not just different in degree. They are completely opposite in kind.
They really are.
Ibogaine's defining hazard is acute. It can kill you right there on the table. Its primary risk is to the electrical system of the heart.
It operates through a very specific cardiac mechanism. Ibogaine and its metabolite block the HERG potassium channel in the heart muscle.
The HERG channel?
Yeah. This delays repolarization and prolongs what cardiologists call the QT interval on an EKG.
Okay, give me an ELI-5 on the QT interval. What happens when it gets prolonged?
They give your heart's electrical system like the flash on a digital camera.
Okay.
After the flash goes off to trigger a heartbeat, the capacitor needs a fraction of a second to recharge before it can fire again.
Right, it needs to reset.
The QT interval is that recharge time. Ibogaine slows down the recharge.
Ah, I see.
If that interval stretches too far, the heart's electrical rhythm can become completely chaotic, a condition called torsade de pointe, which is a potentially fatal cardiac arrhythmia.
Wow. The briefing cites a 2012 review that documented 19 fatalities temporally associated with ibogaine ingestion.
It's a real danger.
Though it notes most of those were clustered around patients who had pre-existing heart disease, were concurrently using other depressants, or were in settings with totally inadequate medical screening.
And this is exactly why rigorous hospital-grade cardiac monitoring is absolutely non-negotiable for this substance.
It can't be done in a living room.
No. It's also why modern medical protocols are evolving to actively buffer that risk rather than just watching a monitor. A prime example is the 2024 Stanford MYSTIC Protocol.
Oh, that was a landmark study.
It really was.
They took 30 U.S. Special Operations veterans suffering from severe traumatic brain injury and PTSD guys who had literally tried everything else and treated them with ibogaine at a clinic in Mexico.
And the results were astounding.
Yeah. Their average disability score, the WHO's, dropped from 30.2 to 5.1 just 1 month after a single treatment.
It's incredible.
But the crucial detail in the briefing isn't just the result. It's how they managed the safety. They co-administered intravenous magnesium specifically to protect the heart.
Right. Magnesium acts as an electrical stabilizer. To return to the camera analogy, it's like putting a surge protector on that recharging capacitor.
That makes perfect sense.
It actively buffers the QT interval prolongation, keeping the rhythm steady while the drug works on the brain.
Okay, now let's shift your perspective entirely to ketamine.
Different ballgame.
Totally. Ketamine does not carry that acute risk of sudden cardiac death. Its risks are chronic, behavioral, and accumulative.
Because it's a Schedule III controlled substance, it carries genuine abuse and dependence liability.
And the briefing notes this is being heavily amplified right now by at-home telehealth prescribing where patients are unsupervised.
Yes.
But the physical damage from chronic use is what surprised me most. It causes something called ulcerative cystitis.
It's awful. Roughly a quarter of long-term heavy ketamine users develop severe lower urinary tract symptoms. Yeah. The drug and its metabolites are excreted through the urine, and in high concentrations over long periods, they literally become toxic to the lining of the bladder.
Ouch.
It causes painful inflammation, ulceration, and, in extreme cases, irreversible shrinkage of the bladder capacity.
That sounds horrific.
Acutely, during the dose itself, it can also spike blood pressure and heart rate and push a patient into severe dissociation. The notoriously disorienting K-hole.
So to put it bluntly, ibogaine is an acute physical risk-like skydiving where the danger is immediate, severe, and right in front of you.
Yes.
Whereas ketamine's risks are much more insidious. Mm. It's a damage that silently accrues over time with repeated exposure or misuse.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it explains entirely why the clinical safety protocols for these two drugs look like they belong to different medical specialties.
Right.
With ibogaine, you are running EKGs to prevent sudden cardiac arrest. With ketamine, you are screening for a history of substance misuse and monitoring bladder health over months and years.
Which perfectly explains why regulators treat these two drugs like they are from entirely different planets.
They basically are.
Let's look at the legal and research reality of where we stand in 2026. Because of its safety profile and deep base of randomized controlled trials, ketamine is a fully regulated, established player.
The regulatory landscape for ketamine is firmly set.
Right.
As we discussed, esketamine, the Spravato nasal spray, was FDA approved for treatment-resistant depression back in 2019.
But in January 2025, the FDA actually approved it as a standalone monotherapy.
Which is huge. It means patients no longer had to take an oral antidepressant alongside it. That was a massive milestone.
And it remains Schedule III, and the DEA even extended telemedicine prescribing flexibilities through the end of 2026. It is highly accessible.
It's everywhere.
Meanwhile, ibogaine is stuck in an entirely different paradigm. It remains Schedule I in the U.S., meaning the DEA classifies it as having no accepted medical use. The evidence base we just talked about, like the Stanford Veteran Study, it's mostly small observational data. There are no large randomized controlled trials yet.
Not yet.
For years, legal access meant traveling abroad to Mexico or New Zealand. But the briefing highlights some massive legislative shifts happening right now in 2026.
The momentum is undeniably shifting toward rigorous research. Colorado passed HB 26, 1325, which created a first-of-its-kind state ibogaine research pilot program.
Wow.
Importantly, though, because of the acute cardiac risks we detailed, this is strictly research-gated. It is routed entirely through the FDA's investigational drug process. They are not opening up casual walk-in healing centers.
Definitely not. And then there's Texas. The briefing highlights that Texas just committed $50 million to state-funded clinical trials led by Youth Health Houston.
Yes.
So what does this all mean? I have to ask. Texas is historically a very conservative state. Why is a state like Texas dropping $50 million to research a Schedule I psychedelic that stops the heart?
The answer cuts straight through political lines and speaks to a profound public health desperation.
Desperation.
Exactly. The reality is that the severity of the opioid epidemic, combined with the escalating mental health crisis among combat veterans, has created a situation that lawmakers simply cannot ignore.
They need new tools.
When legislators see the data coming out of observational trials like special ops veterans recovering from severe TBI and PTSD after a single dose in the Stanford study, they recognize that their current tools are failing.
So they have to act.
Right. They are funding these trials because they need to know definitively through large randomized controlled trials if ibogaine's efficacy is real and if its cardiac risks can be safely managed at a population scale.
It's the sheer gravity of the crisis forcing the research pipeline open.
Absolutely.
We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today, from ancient initiation rites to synthetic battlefield anesthetics.
We really have.
If you are listening to this, the main takeaway is that this isn't a competition. It is entirely about fit. Comorbidities dictate the path.
Ketamine is the established, fast, repeatable lever for depression. But if a patient has a history of severe substance use disorder or bladder issues, long-term ketamine is likely contraindicated.
And conversely, ibogaine is the emerging, single-session, high-risk reset for addiction and trauma.
But if a patient has any cardiac history or is taking medications that prolong that QT interval, ibogaine is completely off the table. The heart simply can't take the risk.
Right. Understanding these mechanical differences, the why and the how, is exactly why you should care about this deep neuroscience.
It's empowering.
Because understanding these mechanics inoculates you against the hype. The next time you scroll past a headline touting a miracle cure for depression or addiction, you now know to look for the trade-offs.
You know the right questions to ask.
You know to ask. Okay, is this going to require intensive cardiac monitoring, or am I looking at chronic bladder risks and a lifetime of maintenance? Miracles in medicine always come with a biological cost.
Always. And this raises an important question, something for everyone to mull over as the science advances.
Well,
we know researchers are currently trying to isolate the active mechanisms of these drugs.
Right, separating the good from the bad.
If future neuropharmacology succeeds in isolating the cellular mechanics of ibogaine, say, extracting that GDNF reset loop that rewires the reward circuitry, but doing it without the severe cardiac risk and without the grueling 24-hour waking dream, would it still cure the addiction? Or is the profound, overwhelming psychological ordeal of the experience actually a necessary structural part of how the human brain heals from that level of despair?
Wow. Can you separate the chemical reset from the psychological marathon? I guess we will have to wait for the data from Texas and Colorado to find out. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the headlines, keep looking for the trade-offs, and remember, whether it's a precision scalpel or a sledgehammer, every tool leaves a mark. We'll see you next time.